And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. By the way, that Bob Marley song, I was working in Africa, and I had in Tanzania, and there were thousands of refugees there, and that happened to be their favorite song. If you were around and people, that was the one that everybody sat up for, was No Woman, No Cry, Bob Marley. Phil, you wanted to clarify initially about that film.
Yes, the film, The Ninth Floor, directed by Mina Shum, which is about the events at Sir George Williams University in 1970, will be showing at the film festival on the 12th. And following the showing, the screening, there's going to be a reception at a different book list, which is going to start at 9:30 p.m. So it's probably going to go into the early hours. But the director will be there. So that's a very interesting event that a different book list is sponsoring. And that's Saturday night, the 12th, starting around 9:30 p.m. At 746 Bathurst Street.
So it'd be late, actually.
Yes, it'd be late.
It's a later hour.
It's a later hour.
They first go see the film.
First you go see the film, and then you go back and you meet the director.
The director? Yeah. At a different book list?
At a different book list.
Can you say the number of the street?
746 Bathurst Street.
Okay.
Well, you know what I think?
The little duck comes down and gives you $20.
I'm guessing the screening is at the Hot Docks Cinema, because the festival uses that cinema, which is right at Bathurst and Bloor. So, of course, different book list is just around the corner. So it will work very well. You
know. Well, thank you very much. And again, we'll just remind you, Eve Engler will be at Betsatoon on the 20th of and he's going to be in Hamilton on the 19th. He's on the tour with his new book, Canada and that's what never say never look away from your notes. I forget the title of the book, but it's about Africa, the exploitation of Africa. It's Eve Engler, and it is a heavy piece of work, and I really congratulate him. And so in his lectures, of course, you can update by seeing him. Of course, he will have the latest sort of nuances growing out of the events that are taking place in Africa today. This is the Taylor Report, and we will be speaking shortly with Zafar Ben-Gesh. Zafar Ben-Gesh is the editor of crescent-online.net. And then, of course, we have this news from Syria in the form of the tragedy of the child. I'll just say while we're waiting for Zafar that I'm really glad to have raised this fact that Syria was has hosted for half a century, for longer actually, in the case of the Palestinians. We're talking about should we take 2,000, should we take 3,000 refugees? They took them in the tens of thousands. They took Palestinian refugees. They took Lebanese refugees. And I raise this matter. This is a sensitive topic, but in fact, now Syrians are having to cross into Lebanon seeking status as refugees. They haven't found the same warmth towards themselves that they express towards the people of Lebanon, and that's a touchy issue. And we're going to ask Zafar Ben-Gesh about that. And Zafar Ben-Gesh has joined us, I believe. You're there, Zafar.
Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and we're very glad to be talking to you. We just spoke to Sister Agnes Mariam in Syria.
Oh, terrific. And wonderful, wonderful person.
Yes, and by the way, she was nominated by the Irish woman, a peace advocate, for Nobel, and after listening to her, I think she should get that Nobel Prize.
Yes, Mary McGuire, McGuire nominated her, exactly.
Now, I just mentioned something, a touchy issue, and that is that here we have Syria, and I wanted, of course, when I first got in touch with you about this, I thought we'd be talking about Lebanon, and I guess we will, but since then, of course, there's been these shocking photographs and strange reactions by people in power in the West as to what to do with Syrian refugees, et cetera, or should they accept them. And I was reminded that the Syrians if we were talking 20 years ago, we would be talking about how many thousands of refugees had entered Syria and were being sustained in Syria.
Yes.
Iraqi Christians and Muslims.
Yes.
And they also have, of course, very long time, the Palestinians and Lebanese. And now Syrians find, some of them, I've been told, when they cross into Lebanon, do not receive the warmth of reception that the Lebanese received when they went into Syria. Why is Syria being treated this way?
Yes. Well, let me first of all say, yes, you are right that for decades the Syrians welcomed various kinds of refugees fleeing wars, etc. I mean, you know, right in Damascus itself, there are a number of Palestinian refugee camps. Yarmouk camp is very famous, well known, because there have been a lot of incidents around that have been exploited. Many Palestinian factions were accommodated in Syria. So there's a very, very long history of the Syrians welcoming people fleeing wars. And now when we find that Syria is subjected to this horrific war, which is, of course, imposed from outside, and the Syrian people are forced to flee and take these desperate measures, you know, as we had over the last week or so, this incident of this young boy, Aylan Kurdi, you know, this really, really heart-wrenching picture that we saw that moved the whole world. And this sort of brought to the living rooms of all the people as to what is really happening. Now, with respect to Lebanon, let me say this, that Lebanon has welcomed 1.2 million Syrian refugees. Now, that's more than one quarter of Lebanon's total population. Mm-hmm. Lebanon's population is 4 million. They've taken 1.2 million Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. And what you said with respect to some Lebanese not welcoming them, this is true, but let me mention that, in fact, the overwhelming majority of Syrian refugees have been welcomed by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is looking after them, providing them food, providing them shelter, providing them free medical facilities, because in Lebanon, the government structure has virtually collapsed. Today, there isn't really a government of any sort in Lebanon.
There's no president, right?
No president, exactly. And there hasn't been a president since May of 2014, because some of these Lebanese politicians that are in the pockets of the United States or France or Britain or Saudi Arabia, they refuse to come to an agreement to have a Lebanese president. Now, I'll tell you where the deadlock has come about. Hezbollah and its allies would like to have Michel Aoun, a former general, as the president, and he's the person who could probably bring about stability to the country. He has a good track record, whereas Saad Hariri, son of a former prime minister, Rafiq Hariri, mm-hmm. His group is supporting a person by the name of Samir Jaja. Now, Samir Jaja is a former warlord who has a lot of blood on his hands. He murdered a lot of Palestinians. He was, in fact, an ally of the Israelis during that Israeli attack on Lebanon back in June of 1982 that lasted until September of 1982 when we had the Sabra and Shatila massacres.
Yeah, they had Beirut surrounded.
Exactly. This is the month in which, in fact, in a week's time, it would be the anniversary. It would be, in fact, the, let me calculate, it would be the 33rd anniversary of the massacres at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in which these, Samir Jaja's phalangists, these are absolute thugs, mm-hmm. absolute brutal killers that went into these camps and they murdered people for 2 days and two nights. And the Israelis had surrounded the camp, and at nighttime they would fire flares so that these killers could go and do their job. And it was only later that the world woke up to that horrific massacre that was perpetrated over there. Mm-hmm. So today we see politicians like Saad Hariri supporting these killers, these mass murderers, and that person to become the president of Lebanon. So that's where the deadlock is in Lebanon.
By the way, you mentioned it, but isn't it a remarkable situation that the Hezbollah is and other Lebanese would be willing to work with and support General Aoun?
Yes,
actually, that's quite progress for Lebanon.
Sure, absolutely.
That is thinkable.
Yes, you see, the thing is that
A patriot?
He is. Actually, the Lebanese constitution is framed in such a way. I'm personally not really in favor of it because it works against the interests of the majority of the people in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But this constitution that was forced upon Lebanon by the French back in 1935, I believe, or 1943, I don't remember the exact date, but anyway, it was imposed by the French. And according to that, what the constitution stipulates is that the prime minister of the country would be a Sunni Muslim, the president would be a Christian, and the speaker of parliament would be a Shia Muslim. Now, that was imposed by the French.
The modern French secularist thinkers.
That's correct.
Dreamed that up.
Absolutely. And it is imposed to this day. Now, I know for a fact that if, let's say, this colonial constitution were removed, I think somebody like Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, who's the head of Hezbollah, would win hands down as president of Lebanon. Not only because the Shias are today the majority in Lebanon, but the Hezbollah have done such a wonderful job in Lebanon in terms of providing services to all the people. Like, you know, Hezbollah-run hospitals are far superior to government-run hospitals, and they do not discriminate against Sunnis or Christians or Druze or anybody else that comes to seek treatment in their hospitals or in their welfare centers. And they are so supported and loved by people in Lebanon. I mean, I've myself been to Lebanon, and I can tell you, I witnessed it, not recently, but a long time ago, that, and Beirut, unfortunately, is split up between Muslims and Christians. Mm. And if you were to go to, for instance, East Beirut, which is predominantly Christian, and if you witness or see one of the Hezbollah leaders come over there, people would actually come out, Christians would come out, and they'd want to shake his hands and applaud him when he walks there. Wow. I mean, it's such a remarkable, you know, scene. I witnessed it myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really astonished to see that kind of support for them because, you know, in Lebanon, people don't see them in sectarian or religious terms, but they see them as true patriots and true defenders of Lebanon and its honor and integrity. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing that really, Hezbollah is the only...
They scored one of the great military victories against Israel, which is a mighty powerful organization.
Exactly, exactly.
And so every Lebanese would, it's kind of like, that's your team, right?
Absolutely, exactly. That's although, you know, people like Saad Hariri and their, you know, Saudi backers and Americans and others have been pressing that Hezbollah should be disarmed, whereas in fact, you know, the Lebanese army simply is not capable of taking on Israel. It is only Hezbollah that has been able to defend Lebanon from further encroachment by Israel. Mm. So that is the situation that we find in Lebanon today.
Yeah. And that brings us, by the way, I have to this issue, this strike. I see the reporting of it seems... I would say almost every commentator I read has some kind of suspicion. And by the way, they write from different political vantage points. But can you explain, what is this strike about? And is it going to lead to some type of political change?
Well, basically, the strike on the surface is a about garbage, and that's true. There is a garbage dump in a part of Lebanon that was shut down in mid-July, July 17th, because it simply couldn't take any more garbage. And, of course, the government, as I said, the government really doesn't exist. And so they were unable to find an alternate site where this garbage could be put away. There have been allegations that some ministers have been involved in scandals in terms of sort of internal fighting with respect to who to give the contract to so that they could collect the garbage and take it away, etc. And as a result of an impasse between these various ministers vying for this contract, because they were also going on the take, they would have got some money, pocketed it, that no contract was awarded to anybody. So right now, since mid-July, there has been no garbage collected from the streets of Beirut. So it's piling up all over the place. Mm-hmm. And naturally, if you, you know, I mean, if you don't have garbage being collected, it being the month of summer, it you know, vegetables and other stuff, mm-hmm. petrifying and putrefied.
Well, somebody will have to do something.
Exactly.
I mean, you got a danger of that becoming, you know, there's words like cholera or
yes,
various other
exactly.
things that will happen. I've heard that Hezbollah has moved into a position rather more overtly sympathizing with the strike. And with desiring a resolution, I got the impression that some of the parties were hanging back. They hadn't decided what to make of this.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
I'm not aware of Hezbollah's position on this, but obviously they will always take a position that is in favor of providing services to the people and alleviating the suffering of the people. They've always done that. So I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. But what I have known and found is that the garbage strike, which is absolutely genuine because people are fed up, is being exploited in other ways. I mean, there have been reports of agent provocateurs that have infiltrated the group, and now they are, you know, making other demands. For instance, one of their demands was the resignation of the Minister of the Environment. And he offered to resign, as did the prime minister. But then people, the sensible people in Lebanon said, okay, if the minister resigns and the prime minister resigns, would that move the garbage or the garbage would still be there? So what is it that they're going to achieve by that?
Yes.
So unless and until they find a solution to the problem, simply the resignation of somebody will not solve the problem. Of course, you know, the minister or the prime minister being there is not doing anything either, because they're not doing anything with respect to the situation of the garbage collection. But the way I read this whole situation is as follows, that I think this garbage crisis is being exploited in terms of creating a crisis inside Lebanon. In fact, there have been reports of some attacks in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Hilwa, and that obviously is deliberately being instigated because that would create a sort of civil war situation in which the Palestinians would be attacked. That would embroil Lebanon in an internal conflict. That would then open an opportunity for Israel to attack, because Israel is deeply involved in Lebanon, at least in the south. You know, Israel still sits in occupation of Sheba Farms. And there is also the Golan Heights, the Syrian occupied, that belong to Syria, but Israeli occupied, where the Zionists are supporting al-Nusra, this terrorist group that is operating in Syria. And the aim, the Israeli aim, appears to be to embroil Lebanon in an internal conflict so that would force Hezbollah to withdraw its forces from Syria, where it's supporting the government of Bashar al-Assad to maintain or to remain in power against these terrorist groups. So if Hezbollah were to withdraw from Syria and come to Lebanon, then Hezbollah would get involved in an internal conflict in Lebanon, something that it has avoided for decades. It doesn't want to get involved. And at the same time, it would weaken Syria. Mm-hmm. And so that is the situation or scenario that Israel and Saudi Arabia and the U.S., etc., are trying to create in order to exploit.
Mm-hmm. This is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Zafar, there's so many other related matters, and I want to make sure I ask you about. Today, the government of Qatar said that it's going to send 1,000 soldiers to Yemen.
Yes.
And by the way, the media here keeps saying an Arab coalition, I think they call it, Arab coalition for. And who are the? What is that coalition? I haven't heard about Algeria being part of it, or certainly not Syria is not part. Who is that?
Well, Algeria has actually said it is not going to send its forces over there. And Oman, another member of the Gulf Cooperation Council, has flatly refused to send its forces. Yeah. Essentially, it is a Saudi-led invasion of Yemen, in which United Arab Emirates plays a crucial role. And then you have, of course, now, and there are Bahraini forces, and Qatar has now got involved. There are a few Egyptian advisors as well involved. Initially, if you recall, a few months ago, when we had, or just before the Saudis actually launched their attack, they had asked Pakistan as well, but I had said that Pakistan will not get involved, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what has happened is that the Saudis, it's essentially a Saudi war, but backed by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and now Qatar as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Saudis have been doing is bombing Yemen massively. I mean, they've caused thousands of casualties over there. The UN itself has said at least 4,600 civilians have been killed. Nearly 600 children have been mm-hmm. killed. Twice that number have died. According to the UN, 22 million out of 24 million Yemen's population is food deficient at the present time. But the Qatari announcement that came yesterday came in the wake of an incredibly significant development that took place on Friday. The Yemeni fighters were able to fire a rocket at an airport in Ma'arib province in South mm-hmm. Yemen, where Saudi and Emirati forces were stationed.
Mm-hmm.
And they fired that rocket at that airport. It's called Al Safir Airport. And the rocket hit an ammunition dump.
Mm-hmm.
So it caused a massive explosion in that ammunition dump. From Friday night for the whole day Saturday, there were massive explosions, fire, rockets were firing all over. And it was reported that 75 to 100 Emirati troops have been killed. The Saudis have admitted to losing 10 soldiers, but other reports that I've read said that there is a lot more than that. In fact, the total casualties of these foreign mercenary forces that are occupying parts of Yemen, some reports have said there are as many as 300.
Wow.
And obviously this is a major blow to these invaders of Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a consequence of that, with such massive loss, and it has obviously caused great grief and anguish in United Arab Emirates, because if they have lost about 100 of their troops, that's almost like 1%
yes.
of their total armed force is gone in one missile attack. And so they've been forced to get help or seek support from others. So that's where the Qataris come in.
Mm-hmm.
That they announced that they're going to be sending 1,000 troops.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they'll send them directly into Yemen or they are going to be stationed in bases around Yemen, the southern part of Saudi Arabia, because there are a number of Saudi bases over there that have also been attacked. But one interesting development that occurred day before yesterday was that a Yemeni a brigadier general by the name of Sharaf Luqman, he said that because the Saudis have attacked our country, they are bombing our civilian infrastructure. They have even, you know, destroyed most parts of our 7,000-year-old capital, Sana'a. Now, cities, Saudi cities like Riyadh, Jeddah, and Abha are legitimate targets, and we are going to target them now. So I think, and I wouldn't take that threat lightly, because the Yemenis are capable of doing that. They will be able to carry out the threats because they feel that they have really, you know, the Saudis have perpetrated a lot of crimes in their country, and now they are justified in doing what they would do.
Yeah, now that is a sobering thought. And if you consider, these are absolute monarchies who, as you mentioned, by the way, a lot of mercenaries are involved here.
Yes,
I noticed reports that we're not just talking about Arabs. There's people being hired for their skills.
Yes.
And
yes.
Such people are rarely, they don't have a drop of patriotism, but they're also capable of losing their nerve. Just because you have heavy weaponry and all that, and it doesn't mean that you're going to get away with things. This is a population versus a population, two different types of people altogether.
Yes. In fact, you know, the Saudis have hired Senegalese mercenaries as well. So they are operating over there. And they would buy anybody that is willing to fight for them, because their own soldiers are such cowards that they sort of, you know, run away at the first sound of the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis have never been known for any bravery except for cruelty.
Yes.
So, you know, they perpetrate horrible crimes against defenseless people, but they just don't have the stomach for a fight. And that's why they've been bombing from the air, because it's considered to be safe. But I think even that is not guaranteed now, because over the last 3 days, three Saudi Apache helicopters, U.S.-supplied Apache helicopters, were also shot down.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that additional now challenge that the Saudis face from the Yemeni forces. And the Yemenis are absolutely brilliant fighters. I mean, they've historically been very, very good fighters. Mm-hmm. They're extremely poor people, but very, very dignified. And
poor but proud.
Very proud people. Very, you know, guerrilla fighters, actually. And that's what really is going to ultimately tip the balance in this war.
Well, I find all this very encouraging. Zafar Benghazi, there were so many things to talk about, and you've covered so much of the ground. We really are grateful. Crescent-online.net, everyone should go to that site. Zafar, again, thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Keep
up the good work.
Thank you.
Excellent.
We'll do that. Zafar Benghazi, and he does have a great website, and as you probably noticed, very articulate, knowledgeable. He'll tell you when he knows something, he'll tell you when he doesn't know something, that's really good. Well, you've been listening to the Daily Report. I want to thank Phil Conlon and Lucas, and we'll see you next week.